Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. A hopeful date for the start of Syrian peace talks. The UN envoy on Syria says he had hoped to convene peace talks between Syrian government and opposition members in Geneva today. This is Special Envoy Staffan de Mistura.
Due to the intense disagreements, frankly, and different opinions on who should be on the list, the actual beginning of the talks, which was meant to be today, 25 January, have been delayed.
But the special envoy said he was sending out invitations for the talks on Tuesday.
And the date which we'll be aiming at having the beginning of the intra-Syrian talks, 29th of January.
And that would be this Friday. Speaking during a visit to Laos, Secretary of State John Kerry said it's better to wait a few days and properly set up the process rather than have it fall apart on the first day. The U.S. is stepping up its efforts to help Laos deal with problems including hunger, unexploded ordnances, and technology access for the lower Mekong. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry outlined the initiatives during a visit to Vientiane today, where he will be laying the groundwork for a February summit with leaders of 10 ASEAN countries that will be hosted by President Obama. Carl Thayer, a defense analyst at the University of New South Wales, says Laos will have to balance its international diplomacy as it takes over the chairmanship of ASEAN.
Obama is going to visit the region in May, particularly to Vietnam. He's setting up in the last bit of the year where American diplomacy can go with Laos as chair and to try to keep it on an independent and neutral course, rather than leaning towards China, which some people argue would be the case.
This is VOA News. In Malawi, the United Nations Children's Emergency Fund, or UNICEF, is carrying out a mass screening exercise for malnutrition in children under 5 years of age in 25 of the country's 28 districts. The exercise is in response to a recent vulnerability assessment report, which revealed 2.8 million people in Malawi are facing food shortages. Lamek Masina visited one of the screening centers in Zomba District in southeast Malawi and reports for VOA.
It's 8 o'clock in the morning. The Chamba Screening Center in Malawi's old capital, Zomba, is jam-packed with mothers who have access to malnutrition treatment and want their babies screened. Eliza Kadeya, a resident of Chiwanganya village, had her 3-year-old child diagnosed as malnourished. She told VOA she's not surprised. She says she doesn't have food at home and it is becoming difficult even to find piecework to earn money for buying some food. And she says, for example, most of the babies that are crying here is because of hunger. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Zomba, Malawi.
Malawi is currently facing the worst food shortage in a decade, largely because of flooding and drought that hit the country last year. Brazilian officials have announced measures to prevent the spread of the Zika virus during the Rio de Janeiro Olympic Games later on this year. Brazil is suffering from an outbreak of the virus, which might be behind a spike in cases of infants being born with unusually small heads. A meeting of the World Health Organization that's going on right now in Geneva sheds more light on the virus, but urges caution. This is Director General Margaret Chan.
Although a causal link between Zika infection in pregnancy and microcephaly has not, and I must emphasize, has not been established, the circumstantial evidence is suggestive and extremely worrisome.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control is warning pregnant women to avoid travel to countries and territories in the Caribbean and Latin America affected by the virus. Dr. Beth Bell is with the CDC.
Our growing concern now over the last short period of time is that a pregnant woman with Zika virus infection, that infection can be passed to the fetus.
The CDC says there are no vaccines to prevent the spread of Zika, no drugs to treat those who are affected. Today marks the fifth anniversary of Egyptians launching protests against longtime leader Hosni Mubarak in a revolt that helped spark a wave of uprisings across the Middle East. Current President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi praised the 2000 revolution, saying it brought a new Egypt. Joe Palca in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Joe DiCapua in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The Director General of the World Health Organization, Margaret Chan, is calling for rapid action to tackle the growing threat of emerging diseases. At the opening of the agency's week-long executive committee session, the WHO chief warned some major global health threats will demand urgent collaborative action in the months ahead.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details coming up. Also in the news, nearly 30 people are reported dead in suicide bomb attacks in northern Cameroon. South African President Jacob Zuma may be asked to get involved in Burundi peace efforts. And EU and Turkish officials meet again on the migrant and refugee crisis as tension over the matter grows in Germany. We'll have these stories plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Sierra Leone, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. In our top story, at least 29 people are reported dead in far northern Cameroon following a series of suicide attacks. The area has been a frequent target of the Nigerian terrorist group Boko Haram. The French news agency AFP quotes a police source as saying at least 30 people also were injured in the town of Bodo. That's on the Nigerian border. Three explosions were reported at a market. Since Boko Haram started attacking the region in 2013, nearly 1,200 people have been killed there. The UN Refugee Agency and other humanitarian groups are appealing for more than $500 million. They say the funds are needed to assist those who fled from Boko Haram militants in northern Nigeria and neighboring countries, and for those who've escaped conflict in Central African Republic. The UNHCR says funds would also be used to help families and communities hosting the refugees. The regional refugee response plans would target protection, education, food security, health, shelter, water, hygiene, and sanitation. Parliamentarians from East African countries are meeting in Arusha, Tanzania this week to learn more about the situation in Burundi. MPs from Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, Rwanda, and Burundi will conduct a public hearing. The Burundi government has sent a delegation as well, led by the Foreign Affairs Minister. This is the second public hearing on Burundi, based on a petition filed by the Pan-African Lawyers Union to the East African Legislative Assembly. The lawyers group had requested more information on Burundi's human rights and humanitarian situation. Hundreds of people have been killed in violence since April, when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term in office. He later won re-election. Also, about 250,000 Burundians have fled to neighboring countries. A UN Security Council delegation visited Burundi last week. Before arriving back in New York, they stopped in Ethiopia to visit AU officials. Radio France International reports the UN and the AU differ on what should be done to restore peace. The Security Council delegation reportedly favors a political solution using mediation and dialogue and military and human rights observers. The AU, meanwhile, is defending its decision to deploy 5,000 peacekeeping troops. Current mediation for Burundi is being led by Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni, but little has been accomplished. There's now word that an effort is underway to get South African President Jacob Zuma involved in peace efforts. Reporter Delia Robertson in Johannesburg has been looking into that. She spoke to me about what led to Mr. Zuma's possible involvement.
There were a few initiatives. There was one initiative from the Tanzanians. As you know, President Museveni, as regional leader, has been leading an initiative to try and resolve issues between the parties in Burundi. And then the African Union appointed a special envoy to Burundi, and that was Pascal Inyabenda. he's the Speaker of the Parliament and he's acting as an envoy, I guess, for both sides. And then there was a meeting earlier in South Africa, and then there was the AU meeting, and I guess all of these issues were discussed. And some of the parties involved recalled that President Zuma had been involved in the Burundi peace talks that ended the Tutsi minority regime and brought the majority regime under President Nkurunziza to power. And, of course, his determination to serve a third term is what has precipitated the current crisis.
Well, Delia, does this appear to be stepping on President Museveni's toes?
It doesn't seem so. It seems that the Tanzanians actually asked South Africa to get involved because of President Zuma's experience in the country in the past, and because the initiative basically seemed to be stalled. But they are waiting for a formal invitation to get involved. They're not involved as yet, but there's been discussion around it, and apparently this has been taken back to the various parties in Burundi, you know, with a request that an invitation be issued to South Africa.
Besides Burundi, has Mr. Zuma any other mediation experience that you know of?
You know, he was involved here in South Africa in the negotiations committee of the African National Congress, which ultimately, of course, led to a change in power and an ANC-led government in this country. Also, I believe he was deployed by President Mbeki on other initiatives while he was deputy president in East Africa. I believe he went to Sudan on one occasion and a couple of other things. And Mr. Mandela also used to use him sometimes as a personal envoy when matters of contentious nature arose, either at home and or abroad. He often acted for Mr. Mandela as a personal envoy.
Has there been any comment from the president's office about these reports?
No, the only comments we've heard have come from the International Relations Minister, Nkwani Mashabane, who has said that both she and the president have met with the Tanzanians and the Burundian special envoy. She's subsequently met with them on her own, and that where things stand right now is that there's apparently quite a strong possibility that a formal invitation will be issued.
That was reporter Delia Robertson. She spoke to us from Johannesburg. EU officials are meeting with Turkey's foreign minister about the ongoing migrant and refugee crisis. EU's foreign policy head, Federica Mogherini, says the talks will center on the action plan agreed to last year to deal with the crisis. But she says the EU needs to give more support to Turkey, while Turkey needs to better manage the flow of refugees and migrants trying to reach Europe. At the same time, Germany and Austria want Greece to do more to slow the flow of migrants and refugees to the rest of Europe. Greece is the main arrival point for refugees in Turkey. The two countries are calling on Greece to reinforce its borders and accept help to do so if necessary. There's fear the crisis could threaten Europe's passport-free zone. About 1 million migrants and refugees arrived in Europe last year, about half are from Syria. About 3,000 people died making the journey, with many drowning in the Mediterranean and Aegean Seas. In related news, Germany is tightening its migration laws as huge numbers of refugees arrive on its borders. It's doing so with several Balkan states now designated as safe countries to deport failed asylum seekers. Henry Ridgewell reports from a town in southern Germany where tension is growing over rival visions for the future of migration.
Across Germany, former military barracks, relics of the country's recent history, are being converted to cope with its 21st century crisis. One compound outside the town of Schwäbisch Gmünd near Stuttgart houses 200 asylum seekers from 25 different countries. In the communal kitchen, Gambor and his friends are cooking a lunch of local sausage and cabbage. Gambor is from Bosnia, recently designated as a safe country by the German government, meaning it's less likely he'll gain asylum.
Das ist deine Land, für mich keine Land. Gib keine Land. Das ist meine Land, aber für mich keine Land.
Gambor says it is not safe in Bosnia. It is not safe for my family. It is not safe for my children. His friend Amir is from Kosovo, another country recently designated as safe. My brother is dead. My father is dead. Both were killed, he says. I escaped Kosovo with my children, with my wife. If we were still in Kosovo, we would be killed. Local authorities do not discriminate against any nationality. The refugee's fate is decided in asylum tribunals. New refugee housing is being built nearby, designed to house 160 refugees. But the site was attacked by arsonists in December, putting the project back by several months. The local mayor, Richard Arnold, says Germany is dealing with the migrant crisis on its own, and other European countries must share the burden.
What we need definitely is a consistent immigration policy, which we do not have at the moment as Deutschland, as Germany. And it also needs, of course, a discussion over the item of the frontiers, the European frontiers. At the moment, what we realize is that Europe falls apart.
Europe is hardening its stance. Germany is tightening asylum laws. The EU is developing a beefed-up border force. But Schwäbisch Gmünd's regional lawmaker Klaus Pavel, a member of German Chancellor Angela Merkel's Christian Democrats party, says Europe has a moral duty to help.
Wir sollten bereit sein, alle auf der Welt.
He says that all of us in the world who are able to should be prepared to help, to take in people who are in need. In Schwäbisch Gmünd, local authorities insist the best response to concerns over migration is to integrate the refugees as quickly as possible and prove that they can be an asset to German society. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Schwäbisch Gmünd in southern Germany.
The head of the World Health Organization is calling for rapid action to tackle the growing threat of emerging diseases. Dr. Margaret Chan warns that some major global health threats will demand urgent, collaborative action in the months ahead. Lisa Schlein reports on the opening of the WHO's week-long executive committee session in Geneva.
WHO Chief Margaret Chan appeared chastened when she told some 1,000 delegates attending the meeting that hard lessons have been learned from the Ebola epidemic, which has killed more than 11,000 people in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. WHO was slow off the mark in addressing this unprecedented outbreak, causing the deadly virus to wreak havoc in West Africa and cause panic around the world before measures to contain the disease were fully implemented. After a lot of soul-searching and advice from experts, WHO has begun a reform process. Dr. Chan says she is determined to change the way the WHO responds to outbreaks and emergencies.
Ebola taught the world that an outbreak in any part of the world can have global repercussions. In a profoundly interconnected world, there is no such thing as a local outbreak, and there is no such thing as a faraway war. As some assessments of the Ebola response have concluded, having strong public health infrastructures and capabilities in place in vulnerable countries is the first line of defense against the infectious disease threat.
In the wake of Ebola, Dr. Chan says health officials are more alert to alarming signals coming from the microbial world. She cites the devastation caused by last year's MERS outbreak in Korea, a country with an advanced health system. She says tackling emerging diseases becomes even more problematic in developing and emerging economies. She warns of the explosive spread of Zika virus to new geographical areas with little population immunity. Zika is a mosquito-borne disease that is believed to cause neurological problems in newly born babies. Dr. Chan flags antimicrobial resistance as a danger of the utmost urgency. She says more must be done to counter the growing threat from non-communicable diseases. She cautions the world to be on alert to the emerging health consequences from climate change. She says programs must be sharpened for dealing with more outbreaks of cholera and dengue. Dr. Chan says says more people will suffer from indoor and outdoor pollution and be vulnerable to health problems resulting from extreme weather events. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Joe DiCapua in Washington. It's 21 minutes past the hour, and here's a recap of our top stories. Nearly 30 people are reported dead in suicide bomb attacks in northern Cameroon. South African President Jacob Zuma may be asked to get involved in Burundi peace efforts. And EU and Turkish officials meet again on the migrant and refugee crisis as tension over the matter grows in Germany. We'd like to hear your thoughts about our stories. You can write us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, Washington, D.C., and the zip code is 20237. New York City may be the world's premier destination for immigrants seeking a better life. But until recently, relatively few Africans came to the city, known as the Big Apple, compared to other groups. But that trend has changed. In fact, New York's African diaspora population has doubled over the past decade. To find out more about this community, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Kim Nichols, the co-executive director of the African Services Committee. It's a Harlem-based nonprofit group dedicated to New York's African diaspora.
The African Services Committee is a team of workers from all over Africa and the rest of the world who provide helping services to people coming from Africa and the Caribbean as immigrants or refugees. Most immigrants, when they get here, at best have a visitor's visa and don't really have the right to stay in this country for very long. So we provide immigration legal services to help people who need to adjust their status, their legal status. Of course, not everyone will be able to find a path to legal immigration status, but we help as many people as we can. We also provide housing services to people living with HIV and their families. So we'll place them in housing and help them pay their rent. But we've very much broadened our health-related focus in the last 10 years. While HIV is now a treatable chronic disease, there are other health challenges like viral hepatitis that are really problematic in the African community and have gotten a lot less attention. So we now are offering free hepatitis B vaccination, for example, free testing, free linkage to care. Untreated hepatitis B will cause many, many cases of liver cancer. So we've tried to sort of normalize HIV by opening up screening for all kinds of other things, including diabetes and hypertension. And we have food and nutrition services. So we have a food pantry that serves about 4,000 or 5,000 people a year. And we have nutrition education and cooking classes.
I know that all immigrants face certain problems. Are there certain things that the African diaspora is looking at that might be a little bit unique or a little more spun to that group?
Yes. I mean, language is an issue. New York City is a very Spanish-friendly city. So language is a first barrier that African immigrants often have if they're coming from West Africa. But I think also the fact that the African community here is fairly small compared to other immigrant communities, there's less of a sort of a welcoming base.
But it is growing, the African immigrant population, isn't it?
Yes, the African immigrant population is doubling about every 10 years.
Why do you suppose that's so?
Well, look at the texture of conflict on the continent, climate change, religious strife, insecurity economically. Despite the fact that Africa as a continent seems to be growing economically, there's still millions of people who can't live a peaceful, economically productive life at home.
You mentioned language instruction. Is there some movement toward, if not cultural assimilation, but at least sort of learning sort of the lay of the land here in the United States and how it might be different, how they can preserve their own identities while they're sort of becoming Americans?
Yes. For example, we've had an African girls club that meets after school and on weekends just to have fun together and try to relate as new immigrants from a foreign country who are trying to find their way in a teen environment in America.
What's that like for them?
Well, for some, you know, exciting and full of opportunity, and for others, terrifying. Right? They don't have the confidence, or those who are less confident have trouble sometimes breaking into popular culture. And there's a growing African cultural presence in New York City in music and the arts, for example. So that's one way in which, you know, tradition is preserved. One of the areas where the African community could probably use a real helping hand is in the development of small business. So we are working on a hair braiding initiative. There are hair braiders collectives on practically every corner all around the neighborhood where we work in Harlem and other areas of the city as well. There are many, many women working in this sort of non-formal work environment, and they don't necessarily have many work protections, and they certainly don't know much about the rights that they are entitled to as workers.
Okay, well, good luck to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Adam. It's really nice to talk to you, and I hope our listeners will come and visit us when they're in New York City.
That was Kim Nichols, co-executive director of the African Services Committee in New York City. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Joe DiCapua in Washington. It's coming up on 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports features and more coming up next right here on the VOA. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Mugabe, who's handing over the rotating AU chairmanship, said his equatorial.
Next on Let's Talk. Traditional music. Are you a big fan? Does it bring good memories to you? Who is your favorite traditional music artist? Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing traditional music. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa. Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the upcoming presidential runoff elections and parliamentary elections in the Central African Republic. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, when host Shaka Sali and his guests analyze the ballot. That's next time on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. Also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on The Voice of America.
The Voice of America, VOA.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Nearly 30 people are reported dead in suicide bomb attacks in northern Cameroon. South African President Jacob Zuma may be asked to get involved in Burundi peace efforts. And EU and Turkish officials meet again on the migrant and refugee crisis. Coming up, music from Sierra Leone, and our feature segment looks at the new U.S. diplomat for Zimbabwe and Niger's man-made green zone becoming under threat. I'm Joe DiCapua in Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sonny Young. Hello, Sonny.
Sporty greetings, Joe.
I understand on this snowy Monday, you got some African football for us.
Lots of African football news, Joe. Cameroon beat the Democratic Republic of Congo Monday 3-1 to advance to the quarterfinals at the African Nations Championship football tournament in Rwanda. Remember, VOA football fans, this competition, also called CHAN, is for locally based players in Africa. The indomitable Lions of Cameroon topped Group B with 7 points from 3 matches. The DRC with 6 points also goes through to the final 8. In Monday's other Group B game, Angola beat Ethiopia 2-1. Angola finishes the tournament with 3 points and Ethiopia with 1 point. Rwanda will host the Democratic Republic of Congo Saturday in Kigali in 1 quarterfinal. And that same day, Cameroon will meet Ivory Coast in another quarterfinal in Butare, Rwanda. Rwanda and Ivory Coast finished first-round play in Group A on Sunday. The Wasps of Rwanda sealed their place in the Final Eight with victories over Ivory Coast and Gabon in their first 2 matches. On Sunday in Kigali, though, the Rwandans did not impress. With a quarterfinal berth already secured, the Wasps were beaten convincingly by Morocco, as we hear now from Mark Ouma.
Morocco's stand hosts Rwanda 4-1 in the capital Kigali as Ivory Coast dismissed Gabon 4-1 in Butare, some 140 kilometers south of Kigali, as Group A action concluded at the Orange African Nations Championship in Rwanda on Sunday. Rwanda and Ivory Coast advanced to the quarterfinals. Earlier on Saturday, Zambia pipped Uganda 1-0 as Mali edged Zimbabwe by a solitary goal in Group D action at the Umganda Stadium in Gishenyi. Zambia has 6 points and qualify for the quarterfinals with a game in hand. Mali has 3 points, Uganda 1, while Zimbabwe have no point. On Friday, Niger and Guinea drew 2-2 as Tunisia and Nigeria played to a 1-1 draw in Group C action at the Nyamiramba Stadium in Kigali. Nigeria topped the group with 4 points. Guinea and Tunisia are tied on 2 points each, while Niger has 1 point.
February is Black History Month here in the United States, and to mark it, my VOA colleague James Buddy will once again have special programming on our Daybreak Africa radio show, and James joins us now with more details.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte here to remind you that February is Black History Month in the United States. And starting Monday, February 1st, we will begin our Black History Month series and daily quiz on Daybreak Africa. Listen every morning as we profile historical African-American and African individuals and events. You can win special VOA goodies by answering one of our daily Black History questions. Please send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. You can also call us on 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942.
9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, select the number 25 to leave us your answer.
Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on the Voice of America. In American-style professional football, the Carolina Panthers will play the Denver Broncos February 7th in the 50th Super Bowl in Santa Clara, California. The Panthers and the Broncos won their respective conference championship games at home on Sunday. In the National Football Conference title game, the Panthers mauled the visiting Arizona Cardinals 49-15 in Charlotte, North Carolina. Carolina's all-around quarterback Cam Newton ran for two touchdowns and passed for two others. Meanwhile, the tough Panthers defense forced seven turnovers in the lopsided game. Earlier in Denver, Colorado, the Broncos edged the defending Super Bowl champion New England Patriots 20-18. Star quarterback Tom Brady and the Patriots had a chance to even the game in the closing seconds, but Denver's defense stopped a two-point conversion attempt by New England. The Broncos are in the Super Bowl for a record-tying eighth time. The Patriots, Dallas Cowboys, and Pittsburgh Steelers have also made eight Super Bowl appearances. Denver is aiming for its third Super Bowl championship, having won back-to-back titles in 1998 and 1999. Meanwhile, the Panthers advanced to the Super Bowl for the first time in 12 years. They lost to the Patriots 32-29 in Super Bowl 38. As I mentioned, Super Bowl 50 will be played in Santa Clara, California, about 70 kilometers southeast of San Francisco. Super Bowl 50 has been nicknamed the Golden Super Bowl because it's being played in the Golden State of California. The game will be held in the home stadium of the San Francisco 49ers, a club named after the miners of the California Gold Rush, and because a 50th anniversary is traditionally golden. As my buddy Uncle Ted Roberts likes to say,
give me gold, bro. Give me gold, bro.
Voice of America.
The German sportswear company Adidas is reportedly trying to end its 11-year sponsorship deal with the International Association of Athletics Federations, which would be a huge economic blow for the sports world governing body. Adidas is the IAAF's biggest commercial sponsor, and the move could cost the IAAF tens of millions of dollars. Media reports say Adidas wants to terminate the sponsorship deal 4 years early, and it's reportedly a direct result of the doping scandal sweeping world athletics. Matthew Beasley is from Henderson Global Investors.
If this is true and Adidas are pulling out on their sponsorship with the IAAF, this would clearly be a sign of them balking in the face of what has been a continual stream of very negative news flow in the athletics industry, which of course is potentially important for Adidas given where they sit relative to Nike. More interesting, I think, as an equity investor is the appointment of a new chief executive at Adidas, the former CEO of Henkel. Adidas has been a company that has generally lagged Nike, both in terms of profitability, returns, and indeed growth. So the opportunity for Adidas to steal a march on Nike under new leadership and perhaps reposition itself away from some of these controversies as relates to athletics clearly could be quite meaningful.
Meanwhile, Beasley compares sponsorship in athletics with sponsorship in football.
Football is a very much larger business than athletics. If football is one of those sports that truly touches every country around the world, and the importance for some of the very largest brands to remain associated with football has been seen very much in their inability to distance themselves from FIFA, from world football, even in the face of immense scandal during 2015. So athletics, while important as a business, is a business that some companies like Adidas could indeed perhaps contemplate stepping away from, whereas football is a business that, quite frankly, is far too important for anybody to turn their nose up at.
Earlier this month, Sebastian Coe, the president of the IAAF, said his organization had a lot of work to do to regain the trust of the public, athletes, and sponsors.
It's very important that we go on doing what we need to do to make those changes. The public, the athletes, the sponsors, the media will ultimately judge us on the changes that we make. We can't beg them for trust. We have to earn it, and we should not be in denial about that. And Dick Pound is absolutely right. This is a long journey. We can make the changes, and we can make those changes quickly, but the cultural embeddingment of this is going to take some time.
That's Sebastian Coe, the president of the International Association of Athletics Federations, or IAAF, speaking earlier this month. Finally, in pro basketball, the Golden State Warriors will host the San Antonio Spurs later Monday night in a meeting of the NBA's two top clubs. The Spurs are riding a 13-game winning streak heading into the game at Oracle Arena in Oakland, California. San Antonio has an overall record of 38 wins and 6 losses. The Warriors, meanwhile, have the NBA's best record, 40 victories and only 4 defeats. That overall record includes 24 wins in a row to start the season. San Antonio will be without veteran star Tim Duncan, who has soreness in his right knee, and he'll sit out tonight. The Warriors have won all 20 of their home games this season, and they're looking to extend a 38-game regular season home winning streak that dates to last season. Golden State star guard Stephen Curry says it's going to be a fun game tonight. Curry leads the NBA in scoring, averaging just over 30 points a game. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Joe DiCapua.
Why, thank you, Sonny. Listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17 hours UTC right here on the VOA. I'm Joe DiCapua in Washington. Well, time now for some music. Tonight, we feature the Sierra Leone Refugee All-Stars with a song near and dear to the hearts of all married couples. It's called Mother-in-Law.
And he made a bikini and a bamboo. So nice.
inside. Sugar they pray for you, the NA to make you better. Sugar they envy you, sugar they battle you. Once you get drunk, sugar really no say you get for better. They came with a law, if you born with the picking. Once you get drunk, sugar really no say you get for prosper. You know for raise the tempo, and you know for bamboo. What you make her talk?
Modelo, when I am modelo.
You give me some good.
Modelo, when I am modelo.
You give me some bad.
Modelo, when I am modelo.
What you not for do?
Modelo, yeah. When I am modelo.
Shame. What's it make her talk?
Modelo, when I you modelo.
You give me some good.
Modelo, when I you modelo.
You give me some bad.
Modelo, when I you modelo.
What's it not for do?
Modelo,
yeah.
When I you modelo.
That was the Sierra Leone Refugee All-Stars with Mother-in-Law. Well, relations between the United States and Zimbabwe have been tense for years now. Many people in Zimbabwe look to the choice of a new ambassador to gauge any shift in policy or relations. Irvin Chifera reports on Zimbabweans' expectations of the new U.S. ambassador-designate, Harry Thomas Jr.
U.S. foreign policy is determined by Congress, the White House, and relevant legislation, and no fundamental political and economic changes have taken place since President Robert Mugabe won the presidential poll in 2013 at the heart of a standoff with Washington over human rights violations, bad economic policies, and alleged electoral fraud. Most Zimbabweans believe that ambassador-designate Mr. Thomas Jr. is widely expected to continue with the same U.S. policies that were being implemented by outgoing ambassador Mr. Bruce Wharton. The Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act of 2001, or ZIDERA, which enforces targeted sanctions imposed on President Robert Mugabe and his inner circle, is still intact with no indications that it will be repealed anytime soon. America has over the years accused President Mugabe and his colleagues of serious human rights violations and electoral fraud. Mr. Mugabe has dismissed the sanctions, saying they were imposed in retaliation to the government's moves to forcibly take over fertile land from white commercial farmers. More than 3,000 white commercial farmers have been displaced from their land following the introduction of the land reforms in 2000. Economic commentator Masimbai Manyanyat said Mr. Thomas Jr. will no doubt continue with America's policy of rectifying many faults in governance issues and ensuring the creation of a democratic state in Zimbabwe.
The new ambassador will obviously carry on with the agenda that has been set by his predecessors. And there's no other way of looking at the agenda except in terms of what American foreign policy clearly says, to pursue democratization and to ensure that there's transparency in governance systems and to ensure that there's protection of the law, the rule of the law, and that that people participate in governance.
Harare resident Jeffrey Moyo agrees with Manyanya, saying there is no way Washington can have a policy shift given the current social, economic, and political situation in Zimbabwe.
The incoming of the new U.S. ambassador won't change anything in Zimbabwe. Their position has always been the same. They seem to be indirectly maintaining the sanctions.
ZANU-PF spokesman Simon Kayamoyo could not be reached for comment. Another ZANU-PF activist, Spencer Rakabopa, concurs, adding the new ambassador was coming to defend American sanctions against Zimbabwe.
To me, it doesn't mean anything and nothing is going to change. We know that America will just maintain its stance even on sanctions.
When Mr. Thomas Jr. was appointed a month ago, he noted that America would always attempt to open dialogue with Zimbabwe. Indications are that he will push for the full implementation of the 2013 Constitution, credible, lasting democratic reforms, and respect for human rights and rule of law by the government of Zimbabwe. Reporting from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
The man-made green belt of vegetation surrounding Niger's capital is under threat from residents who are building within the protected area. That's according to Manu Bage, Director General for the Protection of Vegetation in the Ministry of Agriculture. The 25-kilometer-long green belt was built in the 1960s to surround Bangui and protect it from heavy dust storms and other weather events. Bage tells reporter Ricky Shryock that city authorities are playing a role in the destruction.
The challenge about plantation we have in Niamey Town is that the Niamey Town authorities are building some houses, offices in the plantation. Seeking from them to protect this plantation because of the importance of this plantation, but we have seen that people are destroying this plantation and the offices are destroying too. Because of the town extension.
What risks does Niamey face if this green belt around the city is destroyed or is drastically reduced?
Listen to the authorities.
What happens here? Testing, testing, one. From Washington, this is VOA News.
Green plantation. Take some time to add some new plantation because everybody knows that this kind of green plantation around the town is a very, very important thing for the protecting of people and the building in Niamey.
What is it protecting them from?
The green plantation protecting, we have a few kinds of importance of protection. First, it protects the town from dust and other things in the raining season. You know that we are in the Sahel. In the Sahel, we have some tornadoes. But just second, people can take in the plantation from medicals, traditional medicals. And you have other importance that tree are, the respiration of tree is giving oxygen, taking out the dioxide. You have every kind of importance of this plantation.
There's traditional medicine that people take from some of these trees. Is that what you said?
Yes, yes. Traditional medicine. You can see if people are needing wood for construction and other things, they can prelude on these trees, on the surveillance or on the forestry offices.
Elections are coming up in Niger. Is there a candidate for president who is, you know, more environmentally friendly or someone who is really campaigning that more needs to be done for things such as the green belt? Or are most of the candidates not talking about this issue?
We don't have any candidate that pronounced to protect, especially environment protection. But in their program, everyone have something about the environment protection. But now we are into the campaign. Now we can listen to the candidates and their program to hear what their intention about the environment protections.
That was Manu Bagge, Director General for the Protection of Registration in the Niger Ministry of Agriculture. He spoke with Ricky Shryock. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune into Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Joe DiCapua in Washington. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Al Santos, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Democracy is critical to Africa's future. But if democracy is to take root and flourish, specific conditions must be met. Chief among these are free and fair elections. These, in turn, cannot take place if the voting public lacks access to information about important issues, or if voters are prevented from meeting with or rallying for their chosen candidates. In other words, freedom of speech and of the press and freedom of association are indispensable aspects of free elections and of democracy itself. That is why the United States is concerned about the deteriorating electoral environment in Uganda and the run-up to the presidential and parliamentary elections set to be held on February 18th. 8 candidates are vying for the presidency, including sitting president Yoweri Museveni, who first came to power in 1986 but was only elected into office in 1996. He is currently running for a 5th term in office. According to Human Rights Watch, Uganda's current election campaign is fraught with intimidation of journalists, including threats or warnings of possible repercussions for critical reporting, government harassment and intimidation of independent voices in the media and civil society, obstruction and dispersal by police of opposition rallies with excessive illegal arrests, beatings, and other use of force by security personnel. At least one member of a candidate's staff, opposition campaign aide Christopher Aine, has disappeared. For the sake of Uganda and all of its people, the upcoming elections must be free, fair, and transparent. The United States believes that for this to happen, all Ugandans must have the opportunity to exercise their right to assemble peacefully, express their opinions, and participate in the electoral process free from intimidation and abuse. They also depend on government institutions and security forces remaining neutral, defending the rights of all people and protecting all parties equally, wrote State Department spokesperson John Kirby in a statement. We call on the government, civil society, and political parties to do their part to ensure a peaceful, transparent, and credible electoral process.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the upcoming presidential runoff elections and parliamentary elections in the Central African Republic. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Shaka Sali and his guests analyze the ballot. That's next time on VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.